Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. If you got a problem, and now, your host, Gary Knoll.
If you need a hand, I can assure you this, I can help. I got two strong arms, I can help.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I hope you're having a wonderful holiday. Today, we're going to have a special interview with Dr. Ryan Cole, the COVID vaccines and the pathological evidence of harm. He is one of America's foremost medical doctors and scientists. The whole hour just with him. He's a trained board-certified medical physician who has worked as a board-certified specialist since 2004. He is the co-founding CEO and medical director of Cole Diagnostics in Garden City, Idaho, the state's largest independent medical laboratory, and they use only cutting-edge technology, specializing in pathology and clinical services. He's become one of the more outspoken individuals in the current national pandemic discussion, and especially within the medical community. He's testified before the New Hampshire legislative session. Earlier, Dr. Cole gained expertise in immunology while working as a chief fellow of pathology at the Mayo Clinic and a chief fellow of surgical pathology at the Medical College of Virginia, and received his medical degree from Virginia Commonwealth University. His website is coldiagnostics.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you. I'm grateful for the opportunity, again, just to share some medical truth to your listeners and to our community at large, just to get some messages that are being suppressed out into the zeitgeist for people to think about.
Good for you. When my audience in particular is a combination of physicians and scientists from around the world and lay people, but they all have something in common. Since my entire 56-year radio career is in health, public health issues. And so as a result, we like to look at something. I'm non-political. I don't bring a political or ideological reference. I try to use peer-reviewed literature and good science. But right now, the public is confused. Let me just run over the topics. You select the ones you would like to address, and then the forum will be yours. People are confused by initially being told very high death rates, and therefore everyone was equally susceptible, whether you were an athlete, Olympic champion, or a 90-year-old person, you were all equally susceptible. And hence the idea that we should all immediately go into lockdown, wearing masks, social distancing, etc. And people complied. Then we were told that this is a unique virus that our own immune system was not capable of handling. We were told, stay at home until you get too sick, then go to an emergency room. But what could you do in between being infected and being in a critical care environment was zero. We weren't told about change your lifestyle, change your diet, take supplements, take some medications that were being used by physicians around the world, but not promoted. So then there was an attack against anyone, no matter what their background, and no matter what their success in treating early stage so it didn't get to a later stage. And outstanding people who had never been controversial, never done anything that rose to the level of being criticized by their state medical boards, and now the New York Times, the Washington Post, and all the mainstream media began with one voice to attack anyone suggesting you do anything instead of wait for the vaccine or some very important drug that would come later. And so there was silence on the behalf of the media and the main scientific community, Fauci, etc. But anyone talking out was, and then the third thing is they were banned on all social media. They were attacked. They were attacked on Wikipedia. They were banned from Twitter. And even if the information they were sharing was completely innocuous and factually based from PubMed and respected scientific institutions, in effect, you could have no one in America who could say anything different than what was the official version of the pandemic and how to deal with it. Then we started realizing, is the PCR test, which we were told is the gold standard, is it really the gold standard? Is it going to really give us quality information about infectivity and at what level? And I question that because a friend of mine won the Nobel Prize, Dr. Curry Mullis, for discovering the PCR. And I have an hour and 52-minute film interview of him saying, never use this for diagnosing. And certainly they wouldn't be able to tell you whether it's a current virus or old virus. But none of this got out. So everybody started coming back with false positives. Then something extraordinary happened. The New York Times and then other magazines, newspapers, media started to say that if you were infected or positive, you were a case. Now, in the average person's mind, a case is someone who's sick and needs help and is possibly a super spreader. But there was no challenge to this. Then when people said, well, I got sick, but I'm okay now, does that mean I have natural immunity? And we were told, no, you still must get vaccinated. And then we were told only the people who really needed it were older people, especially in nursing homes and assisted living centers, people with comorbidities. And I'm thinking, well, hold on a second. If they're there because they have multiple immune dysfunctional conditions, what might happen if you inject them with this experimental procedure that then stimulates even more of a reaction? But no discussion of it. There was no debating, no discussion. I didn't find one of the at least 200 individuals that I was aware making statements from Orthodoxy who were invited on to have that discussion. And then we were told that the drug you had to take, remdesivir, would save your life. So when I read the scientific literature, I saw just the opposite, serious effects with kidneys and liver problems. And so now we're at a place where the vaccines are now starting to show us whether they're effective or not and to what degree. And we're still told now vaccines are the best approach, but you got to get your boosters 8 months later. And if you don't do that, like in Australia, you lose your vaccine green card. So now people are going to be lining up to get their boosters. Now children have to take it because they're at high risk, we're told. Those are just some of the inconsistencies that we hear in the official messages. Now, you can take any of that story you want and show us what your detailed research, your cooperation with other scientists have shown the truth to be. The form is yours.
Thank you very much. And yeah, that's a very comprehensive list there. And, you know, I would like to kind of bullet point a few of those and cover those, because these are all excellent questions. And the challenge is getting a message out. The message, you know, that I share and many of my colleagues, be it Dr. McCullough, be it Dr. Corey, be it Dr. Merrick, be it these brilliant physicians who have countless years of experience and countless publications, we've looked at the science. Just because what we say may be something slightly different than what the government narratives or media narratives are, it doesn't mean we're wrong. We invite everybody to look at the data with us. And the frustrating thing has been, I'm going to kind of cover that censorship point first, because what I share today, maybe it will get censored. You know, the fact checkers will come after it, and the fact checkers, one of the biggest fact check organizations is funded by one of the vaccine, has a big investment in the vaccine company. So you have to question motive and narratives there as well. And to your point, a virus and a pandemic is not a political issue. As Dr. McCullough says, look, when you mix politics and medicine, you get politics. And a virus isn't politically blue or politically red or even politically purple. A virus is a humanitarian condition. And if it's a bad one, then we should be working together. We should have dialogue. We should have discussion. If we have disagreement, wonderful. Let's disagree. But let's look at what the data shows. What are the best approaches? What are the best potentials? What are things we should be looking at instead of saying one size fits all? There's only one thing, and what this agency says is all you can do. And then unfortunately, behind some of those decisions from these agencies, there are financial incentives to the hospitals. If you give this drug and this drug, we'll give you a 20% bonus. If you do anything outside the box, you know, no soup for you, you know, going to the Seinfeld reference, you know, no money for you. So there's no incentive to be critically thinking outside the box, approaching this in the every angle possible. Okay, maybe this works 20%. Great. Maybe this works 30%. Maybe this works 40%. it's not a one-size-fits-all. It's not a one-drug approach. They try to demonize one drug. Okay, great. Smart physicians say, okay, this has an effect. Okay, demonize that one. Great. Take it away from us. This one has an effect. And it's insane what we're seeing from these federal agencies attacking the best and the brightest in the country. Dialogue, the cream will always come to the top. Nothing should be censored. In a free society, nothing should be censored, because the conclusions we come to, the best solutions will manifest themselves. And so this Trusted News Initiative that came together last year, the big CDC, ABC, NBC, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Reuters, BBC, I'm probably leaving a few out, or maybe naming one or two that's not in there, but this TNI, if the people look up at what happened in the Trusted News Initiative at the beginning of this year, they said, we will only promote the vaccine, and we will censor anyone that speaks anything that promotes a vaccine hesitancy, and we will suppress anything that speaks about drugs that we don't hear from the CDC or the WHO. So if that doesn't tell you that there is a whole lot of censorship and suppression going on, nothing tells you. Everything should be wide open, and these newspapers should be printing reports from all points of view. I mean, I don't agree with certain things doctors are doing. I don't agree with certain things other doctors are doing. I do agree with certain things. I don't. Back and forth. There are so many effective things. And age groups, this virus, to your point, early on, we had the signals from around the world who was going to be affected by this virus and to what degree. And instead of saying, okay, it's the elderly, the obese, the diabetic, the comorbid, let's protect them, and then let's let the rest of society become a buffer to the illness. It's not that deadly in other age cohorts. Obviously, if you have underlying conditions, those are the people we do guard. But never in the history of humanity have we said, let's lock down the well. That it was illogical. And so much of what we've gone through in this past year has been a game of illogic. And again, never ascribe to malice that which can be explained by ignorance. But I think there's been a willful ignorance to a degree that's really stunning in terms of a science point of view. So the death rates, yes, early on we saw deaths. People were concerned. Back to my point, we know who those individuals were. We should have and could have, and in some cases, we did try to protect them. The death rates, now that we have the data, we know the age cohorts. The older you are with comorbidities, those are the ones that succumbed at the higher rates. But if you look at under age 50, we have a 99.98% survival rate. If we had used early treatments in those cohorts, we could get that close to 100% survival rate in that cohort. You know, we're pushing a shot and things towards children. Those children survived this virus at a statistical 100%. Now we're forcing an experimental shot on children, and unfortunately, yes, we lost some children, but less than a bad flu season, fewer children than in a bad flu season. And I think Dr. McCary out of Hopkins, or Markey, I'm trying to remember what his last name is. Anyway, he did a study and went back and said, look, of those children that succumbed, all of them had an underlying condition except for one or two. So the good news is children statistically do very well with this virus, and yet we're trying to push a shot on them for the which we don't know long-term safety outcomes, be it fertility, autoimmunity, dysregulation of the immune system that could or couldn't lead to, you know, bad cancer outcomes down the road. We don't know. Most vaccines take 5 to 10 years for those safety trials. So everything has been a hammer and a nail to these big agencies and to some of these media groups. There's only fear, suffering, and vaccine instead of hope, early treatment, and let's just get society back to normal. And then in many cases, the cure has been worse than the disease. You look at the suicide rates amongst the younger individuals will far exceed, once we have the numbers, will far exceed the death rate in that age cohort, because we've pushed this fear narrative onto people instead of a, look, we have interventions that save lives, and it's no fun to get sick. I don't want anybody to get sick. And as a physician, it's my job to save lives, as it is for my colleagues. So we've done things that are completely illogical, and we've lost this critical thinking aspect of modern medicine. And so many doctors have lost, I guess, the will to honor the oath of first doing no harm, for one, but also to intervene to save a life. I'm not saying people aren't working hard and doing certain things, but if we do the same thing over and over again with the same result, obviously that's the definition of not being so bright. The virus... Go ahead.
Excuse me. Could you give us some explanations that make sense to us? We're told that nothing can protect us except the vaccine, and yet an awful lot of people, we don't know the exact number, but let us say somewhere between 100 million to possibly 150 million Americans have become sick, many with no symptoms, others with symptoms, but they're survived. Could you compare what the science, the actual science shows now, are the benefits of that type of natural immunity versus the benefits or limitations of the vaccine for immunity?
Absolutely. Natural immunity is a broad-based, long-lasting immunity. SARS-CoV-1, we had individuals in Asia that got SARS-CoV-1 18 years later. They still have T-cell memory to SARS-CoV-1. A lot of people, because we have other circulating common cold coronaviruses every couple of years within the population, part of our immune memory, especially in these patients that did not end up with symptoms, they cross-recognized some of these same proteins on this family of viruses. And to your point, the majority, the vast majority of individuals, 99 point plus whatever percent, depending on the age quartiles, survived this virus. That means we have a robust immune system. Public health message that we did leave out is so goes your vitamin D level, so goes your susceptibility and course of disease with this virus. A large corporate laboratory did 191,000 patient look back and basically showed, look, if your vitamin D level is mid-range at 50 or above, your chance of getting hospitalized was only in the single-digit percentages at most, and your severity of disease was very mild. Did we hear a vitamin D message and how many Americans, 70%, are deficient? We didn't hear that from public health. There's no money in that. There's life-saving in it. And that's because it's not a vitamin, it's a pro-hormone that controls countless genes in your body that communicate to each other in your immune reactions and turn genes on and off. And if you have appropriate levels of that, you can't even get into a cytokine storm or an acute respiratory distress syndrome, because the gene signals talk to each other and tone down. Once it doesn't mean you're not going to get sick, but your course of illness will be milder. Mayo Clinic looked at a study and showed, look, if you're vitamin D level was 30 or below, you had a higher risk of being in the ICU. If it were 20 or below, that was the cutoff for saying, look, you're probably going to be on a ventilator. It increased your risk for mechanical ventilation greatly. So there's a public health message. Ignoring just optimizing immune health. You know, we said, okay, everybody lock down and go home. People ate too much, put on weight, instead of saying, The lower your sugar, the less obese, the higher your vitamin D, the better your sleep, the less susceptible you are to this virus. We didn't say, hey, everybody kind of cut out the sugar and the processed foods, fast for a couple of days. That decreases your inflammatory profile. Simple public health messages ignored. And to your point, natural immunity-wise, once you've had an infection, a vaccine, and these are, you know, investigational vaccines with a modality and a method we've never used on a broad scale on humanity before. So it's a dangerous proposition, not knowing the long-term outcomes on these things. But at the same time, a vaccine is always designed to mimic a portion of a natural infection. And when you're given a shot, you're revving a part of your natural immune response to make a response to that shot. But it's only a fraction of what a natural infection is. So to say that, oh, a shot is better than a natural immunity is insanity, and it's immunology 101 we're throwing out the window. It's anti-science to say that, because when you've had a natural infection, instead of just one protein area of focus, you have 28 areas of focus. And you have T cell memory to all those. And you have broad protein epitopes. You have areas to which your body says, I remember that part, that part, that part, that part. I kind of like to use the bicycle analogy. If you say the front tire of a bicycle is the spike protein and you give a shot, you're making antibodies to that front tire. If you've had a natural infection, now you have antibodies and T-cell memory to the handlebars, the frame, the seat, the pose, the cranks, the pedals, the chain, the back tire, the spokes, the cables, etc. You have a broad memory to that entire bicycle. Now the bike gets into a crash and that front tire is bent. So now we have a delta tire on the front. Well, those who got the shot have some antibodies to that front tire, but a lot of them don't bind because now it's all crinkled and bent. But those who've had a natural infection still remember the entire rest of the bicycle, and the spike is a moot point. It's like, okay, yeah, so the spike is bent, but my body remembers the rest of the virus as well. So you have this memory to that entire components of the virus. And so we've seen in certain studies, there's a multiple-fold increased risk of adverse reactions if you have natural immunity and you're forced into getting a shot. And to say somebody who's naturally immune needs a shot is absolute anti-immunology and anti-science. It's illogical. And in some studies, we're starting to see signals that if you do give a shot, you're favoring that spike response to the detriment of your broad natural memory response. So it can even be really not a good scientific approach to say, oh, we're going to boost your immunity. Another important thing to remember right now is these shots were designed for the D614G, the early Wuhan mutation that was circulating around the world. That mutation of the virus stopped circulating in January or February of last year. We're on to the Delta variant of the virus. And so we're giving the wrong shot for the wrong virus now. Those antibodies that were binding and neutralizing parts of the spike early back in January and February when these first came out, on the Delta, they're binding but not neutralizing. In immunology, that's a bad thing. When you have a binding antibody and not neutralizing, now those antibodies are not your friend. And so an Oxford study out of Vietnam just a week and a half ago showed healthcare workers who had been vaccinated with one of the adenovirus vector vaccines had a 251-fold higher load of virus with the Delta, even though they'd been vaccinated. And that's a bad signal because we are seeing that the virus is higher in copy in the vaccinated than in the unvaccinated. And another very important point is these vaccines, you get a shot in your arm, form some antibodies, whatever, it's an IgG antibody. When you get a natural infection, not only do you get that broad immune response, form IgM, then IgG, form your T cell memory, but you also form, the virus enters our body respiratorily or through the eyes, through the mucosa, you form a type of antibody called IgA. So those who have been naturally infected form a strong, broad component of this IgA antibody. So naturally infected, naturally recovered, naturally immune, you have those IgA. When you get exposed to the virus again, you can quickly bind and neutralize this. Those who get the shot only form a body antibody. They're not forming IgA antibodies. And that's why we're seeing higher viral copies now in the vaccinated who are tending to be the viral carriers, viral spreaders now. And that's a concerning thing. Another important thing, again, going back to vitamin D, in order for a certain type of T cell, your CD4 helper T cells, to talk eventually to your plasma cells to make an antibody, vitamin D is critical in that process. And again, a public health message left out, if you want to maintain a broad natural immune response, take care of your body and make it healthy. Have the things on board that optimize your immune health. Vitamin D is critical in that process and for T cell memory as well. Crickets, when we hear advice from government agencies or universities or whoever is putting data out, oh, by the way, if you want to form and maintain a good, strong, broad, natural immune response over time, and or even a vaccine response, whatever it may be, this is critical for that. You look at the individuals in the nursing homes who got shots and now they're talking second and third boosters with the wrong protein. They're boosting the wrong protein. It's not even in circulation anymore. This is equivalent to saying flu season's coming up. Hey, healthcare workers, we want you all to get your flu shot. But by the way, we've got some leftover flu shots in the freezer from, say, 4 or 5 years ago. We're just going to use those. The healthcare workers would say, no, you're not. I want this season's flu shot. Most of the data now is out the window. So everything that we heard up until basically end of June, beginning of July, that was previous variants. Delta is obviously a wildfire and acting much differently. And so we need to pivot our understanding of where we are. And doing those things that we did early on aren't even technically, scientifically very relevant anymore. And that's concerning to me. Those who are immune, naturally immune, COVID recovered, including myself, were immune likely for a lifetime based on other coronavirus studies.
Let's take a look at three. I appreciate that insight. Thank you. That was very clear. Here are some things that have not been clear. Maybe you could put it into a better perspective for us. In Sweden, they had a very big spike, the same in Italy and the same in Spain. When I looked at the overall epidemiology for year after year, there was a very little difference in overall death. So then I said, well, how's that possible? Then when you start getting into the details that no one in the United States and the main media was doing, you found something that we would rather find abhorrent. But in Sweden, they made a political decision that older people who were in nursing homes suffering from many common diseases, emphysema, cancer, diabetes, etc., should not be treated. In fact, they should just be allowed to die. In fact, in some cases, they were given a particular drug that is used in hospice care that hastens that death process without pain. Now, what was the logic? The logic was, this is going to be such a pandemic, we don't want to wipe out all the younger people. These are older people, and they've had their life. They're at their life expectancy, 80 years and 3 months. They have an average of 2.4 comorbidities. So, you know, that's it. Palliative care, nothing more. So when people would normally be treated for their diabetes or heart disease or cancer, whatever it might be, and they weren't given that quality treatment, it was all going to the resources. And then you start seeing a spike death. You would see that, I believe, in any country if those people who would be getting some form of medical care didn't. Also, a lot of people didn't go to the hospitals. A, they were afraid if they had cancer or had an immune condition that if they went there, it would make them more susceptible to be in that highly toxic environment. And so they stayed at home. And now we see a lot of people who died at home from conditions that could have and should have been treated in a timely manner. I heard something this morning. It was a English person who called the doctor when he saw that there were some problems he had with his face and lesions on his skin. And the doctor said, take a photograph and send it. And he did. And they said, you're fine. And months and months and months went by until his wife said, this is bad. You know, you've got to see. So they took more pictures and sent him. This time they saw him, but after seeing him, they said, we're sorry, there's nothing you can do because you have a terminal cancer, melanoma, and hence put him into a place where he would be able to go until he died. And he was angry, and he was crying, and he said, if my doctor had seen me early, this is a condition that could have been treated. I could be alive instead of facing death. And I listened to it, and it really bothered me. Because how often had that happened? Not because people were out of hand negligent, but because they were thinking, we got to save the medicines, we got to save whatever we have, the beds, for those that are really got COVID because they're the spreaders. So when we look overall now and we look back, we're seeing a completely different phenomena. In fact, one that many epidemiologists have claimed shows that we didn't have a pandemic. We had a virus, yes, and the virus could kill people, and it did, but we didn't have one that should have required people to stay at home, lock in, and all these other measures, and not be treated, not go on diets, not get... I looked in PubMed, and there's over 35,000 studies in PubMed on the therapeutic benefits of vitamin C, quercetin, vitamin D, selenium, zinc, etc. None of that ever discussed. Not a single word about it. If you're going to be home, here's what you should be doing. Exercising, getting outside, getting some fresh air, de-stressing. Here's some things you can do to de-stress. Here's a good diet. Here's juicing, etc. Nothing. And so as a result, it went just in the opposite direction. We had more teenage suicide than at any time in American history. We had more people taking opiates, including OxyContin, than at any time, and we had over 88,000 deaths last year from these different opiates. So no one is accepting any responsibility for that, or nothing in prevention at all. And so now when we look, we say, what happened to the flu? Normally, on a really good year, you might have 35,000 Americans die of flu, but we had none, not a single person. And also Canada, not a single person. In England, not a single person. Well, you know, that's not possible. So then the idea is, what were they conflating? Flu deaths now became COVID deaths. Then we had the idea that if you ended up in a hospital, even if you had terminal cancer and you were in hospice care, when you died, more often than not, it would be COVID on your death certificate. So how many people died, but not from COVID, maybe with COVID, and how do we know they actually had COVID when the PCR test frequently had false positive readings? And so when we put all this into a different historical perspective and look back, where did the flu go? How do we know the PCR test was accurate? How do we know that the deaths were all from COVID? And now other countries are saying, we're not following America's outline anymore. In fact, Denmark is taking away all these procedures. And yet at the same time, there's one person with COVID, one person in the entire country of New Zealand, and they closed the whole country down. And they only had, I think, four people died in Australia, four or seven, and they closed the whole country down and now are arresting people. You go within 2 miles of your house for more than 2 miles for three reasons only, for work, for exercise, or for food. Any other reason, you can be arrested. So when we start looking at what other people are doing, and no one seems to be getting the real message on this that you're sharing with us, could you go through these anomalies, please?
I agree with you, and that's an excellent assessment. And if we look in retrospect at this point, Norway has declared the pandemic over, as has Sweden, and my ancestors in Denmark, same thing. They have basically said, we're done with this virus. What did they do right? They allowed the virus to go into the populations that were at low susceptibility for bad outcomes, built up herd immunity. They were able to keep a society functional. They were able to, at the end of the day, if you look at Sweden's excess death rate, it was 0.03% over any average year. And they had had a couple mild flu seasons prior to this. So they had individuals that were susceptible going into this pandemic, that they were poised to have a slightly increased death rate. But 0.03% over an average year, that tells you that this virus wasn't really a big problem there. And they were able to get through it. It's unfortunate they didn't intervene with some of those elderly individuals, because there are early treatments that work. I've seen them work in countless individuals. Of course, here we have therapeutic nihilism from our government saying there's nothing you can use outpatient. You know, go home if your lips turn blue, then come into the hospital. That's absurdity. We've never done that in medicine before. It's like saying to a woman with, you know, burning and fever and pressure in the bladder, saying, oh yeah, you have a UTI, we'll wait until it's a kidney infection until we treat you. Or gosh, yeah, you have early pneumonia on x-ray and a fever, well, why don't you go home for 2 or 3 weeks and let's see when you're ready for the ICU, then we'll bring you in. Of course not. There are plenty of interventions, you know, be it the hydroxychloroquine. There are now 259 outpatient studies that show it has a benefit in COVID when given early. And there are countless antiviral mechanisms of action we've known about with that medication that's been used for decades upon decades upon this planet that you can give to pregnant women and children and nursing mothers. It's so incredibly safe. And we've terrified a public saying there's nothing you can take. And then there's the naysayer saying, oh, those don't work. I said, look at the data. The data is there. Same thing with ivermectin, countless studies. And I could go over all the mechanisms of ivermectin. Same thing. Early treatment saves lives. New studies, fenofibrate, colchicine for anti-inflammation, steroids at the appropriate dose at the appropriate time in the course of the disease when you're into the inflammatory stage, nebulized budesonide, countless early treatments that save lives. And we've ignored those. Now, to your point about flu, where did the flu go? That's a good question. I've written a couple little articles on this. There's something in virology, it's called social virology. When we study viruses in the laboratory, say just in vitro in a petri dish, if you study them individually, you learn certain characteristics. Now, when you put them in an ecosystem, a milieu of other viruses and bacteria, you realize that they're sending little peptides one to another and signaling. So a virus can send a little peptide to an on or an off gene of another virus. And this is a recent area of science. And we can say, oh, gosh, you know, all our interventions, our masks and our distance stopped the flu. No, they didn't. They never have. No randomized controlled trials ever shown that with the flu. But what likely did decrease the flu was the fact that coronaviruses, cold viruses and flu viruses compete with each other, and they can send a signal to turn an off gene off in another virus. So if you look, go back to the 2009 flu, really, it was a common cold virus, a rhinovirus, that eventually suppressed the influenza season that year. So they compete with each other. It's survival of the fittest. And the signaling goes back and forth. If you look at the data from Northern Europe and the US for the last 50 years, you can see strong flu season, mild flu season, strong cold season, mild flu season, et cetera, et cetera. You can track the quantitation of what types of viruses were circulating. And it's, again, a competition between those viruses. Was flu still existent this year? Yes, most likely. We're even running a huge, busy laboratory doing hundreds of thousands of tests in this given year. Very few flu request tests. And so I think a lot of doctors had just COVID on the brain, and we were under-testing for the flu, to your point. But I also think the coronavirus family of viruses was suppressing flu as well, through that mechanism I discussed. Now, as far as PCR goes, PCR is a very, I've done PCR for decades and decades. I did my undergrad honors thesis using PCR back in the very cumbersome days of doing it. PCR is a very good test when used appropriately in the right way. And Carrie Mullis is correct. You can detect what's present, but it doesn't tell you what something is doing. It's just presence or absence. It's snapshot in time. From my point of view, even though we do testing in the laboratory, it is far more valuable to look at something, and we don't go up to those crazy, you know, 40, 45. Yeah, you get junk amplification at that point, and you get way too many false positives. So to your point, you're correct there. What's useful to me, again, just from a critical thinking point of view, is to say, okay, patient popped at cycle threshold 33. Okay, virus present, maybe present. I don't know if it's live or particle. In a day or two or three, say they're down at 16. Now I know that they're going into infection from a semi-quantitative point of view. I can say I have now not just a snapshot in time, but I have a moving picture, because now I know that they were just exposed and just ramping up. And by the time they're at that lower number, meaning higher viral copy, that's a relevant infection. If somebody comes in and their particle is present and it's 33, 34, two, three times in a row, then they're past an infection and they're just holding on to some particle, which some people can do for weeks and weeks and weeks on end. What does it mean? It doesn't mean anything other than a particle is present, but it doesn't mean anything as far as an infection goes. And to your earlier point, I agree 1,000,000%. We've created a case demic in the world by saying, oh, you have a positive PCR, you're a case. Never in the history of medicine have we done this. If somebody has a symptom and a confirmatory test, then that's helpful in saying, okay, you are a case of that disease. But I could test anybody in any classroom, say in college, and I can find mononucleosis, I can find strep, I can find certain types of fungi, I could swab people's skin and find even MRSA, all sorts of things with a very sensitive test. But if you don't have symptoms from that organism you're carrying, it's because your competent immune system is keeping it at bay. You're not a case of that disease just because I can detect it. So we've lost some sanity in what we're doing in modern medicine, kind of collectively lost our medical minds, and we're saying, oh, it's present, you're sick. I'm like, no, it's present, it's present. And many people, to your earlier point, asymptomatic, never got a symptom. That's because your immune system was competent and just quietly keeping it in the background. You're not a case of a disease if you're not manifesting symptoms of an illness. So why we've allowed public health officials and or government officials to counter what we've known in medicine for a lifetime is really frustrating and illogical. And it's helped drive unfortunate decisions politically, socially, et cetera, for something that's not scientific. And so that's a very frustrating point. And then you look at countries that are locking down, say Australia being draconian, it's ignoring early treatments, being draconian on lockdowns. The number of deaths is far exceeded now. Their data from Dr. McCullough, his analysis, Peter McCullough down in Texas, one of my colleagues, he said, look, we essentially have about a 300-to-1 vaccine death to COVID death ratio right now. The vaccine there is being more deadly than COVID itself. And again, COVID doesn't need to be a deadly disease. In most age cohorts, if you opt to early treat, and these early treatments save lives in the hands of Dr. McCullough, Dr. Zelenko, in my experience, of the countless patients I've treated, not one has gone to the ER or the hospital. And I intervened early, and first patient was my type 1 diabetic obese younger brother. He was on his way to the ER. I said, no, you're on the way to the pharmacy. I used some of these modalities. His pain was gone in a couple of hours, and his oxygen went from 86 to 98 in under 24 hours, kept him out of the hospital. And if we have the will to do this as a medical collective, sure, we can argue over them. I can give you all the antiviral, anti-inflammatory mechanisms of action of all these drugs. It's what I do. I'm a pathophysiologist. I'm a pathologist. I study pharmacokinetics. I study the immune system. I know how they work. And you can demonize them, and you can attack me, all the ad hominem attacks I've gotten. Fine, whatever. Water off his duck's back. But nobody will do ad rem and bring the issue and the data countering what I have. And when I look at that and I say, okay, let's sit down for coffee or lunch. Bring your papers. I'll bring my papers. I'll bring my data. I'll bring my patient cohorts. Let's compare. And it's crickets. Nobody wants to have that engaged conversation. And we should. We should do it on behalf of life-saving for a virus that's not political, for a virus that's a virus. And if we truly... Okay. Go ahead. Go ahead.
Let me give you some ammunition here. We decided to take a look at the actual peer-review literature on hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and some other topics that should be of interest to the average person. Now, the New York Times said none of this was any good. The AMA today just said, you know, don't use ivermectin, it doesn't work. They are wrong. Here's the actual studies. 344 studies, 250 were peer-reviewed, and they were conducted specifically on COVID. 281 studies have been clinical trials involving 4,583 scientists and over 407,627 patients. 64% improvement in 31 early treatment trials, 75% improvement in 13 early stage infection treatments, mortality results, 21% improvement in 190 late stage infection treatment trials, meaning patients in serious condition, 23% improvement in 44 randomized controlled trials, and that's just some. With ivermectin, 131 studies, 52 of which are peer-reviewed, they've been conducted specifically and exclusively on COVID-19. 63 of those studies have been clinical trials involving 613 scientists and 26,398 patients. 58% improvement in 31 randomized controlled trials, 86% improvement in 14 prophylaxis trials, 72% improvement in 27-day stage, early stage infection treatment trials, 40% improvement in 22 late stage infection treatment trials, 58% improvement in 25 mortality results. Now, those are individually, and of course, most people are using collectively in combination. Now, fluoxamine, 88% improvement in early treatment, 29% improvement in late stage treatment, 63% improvement in 7 peer-reviewed studies. Vitamin D, 101 studies conducted by over 875 scientists, 63% sufficiency studies with 34,863 patients, 33 clinical trials with 46,860 patients, 42% improvement by itself in 33 treatment trials, 56% improvement in 68 sufficiency studies, 55% improvement in 19 treatment mortality results. In contrast, there have been 21 studies enrolling 35,744 patients in remdesivir trials, showing only a 22% improvement in all studies combined. This rate is below that of simply taking probiotics, 5 studies at 24% improvement, melatonin, 7 studies at 62% improvement, curcumin, 4 studies at 71% improvement, Nigella sativa, black cumin seed oil, 3 studies at 84% improvement, quercetin, or as the other doctor says, quercetin, 4 studies at 76% improvement, and aspirin, 7 studies at 37% improvement. Despite the small number of trials and low numbers of enrolled participants, early results indicate that greater attention and funding needs to be allocated to these substances rather than the big shot drug that is functionally worthless and dangerous that Anthony Fauci promotes. So now we have all this came from PubMed, by the way. And if you need this, I'll be happy to send this to you. But that's what I sent over to the head of the AMA today. That's what I said to the writer from the New York Times. Before you say that there is no benefit to something, why is it with all your resources and all your intelligent, highly qualified journalists that no one in mainstream media could find what I just shared with you? Because if they looked, they would have found it. If they would have found it, it would have created a conflict between the official version versus the truth in science. And one last thing here that I have waited to the end to ask you about. You're one of America's most respected and leading pathologists, and you're also a physician. As a result, you see what people die from. Isn't it rather interesting that up to this point, there have only been a handful of autopsies on people who have actually died of COVID? And then in Germany, they did about 20 initially. Now it's up to 40 pathologists looking at the cadavers and saying, here's what we're finding. And in one case, they found SARS spike protein in every organ system of the body. We were told that when you get the injection, it's going to stay in the deltoid muscle, and then it'll stimulate the lymphatic system and to create the response that the body wants with the spike proteins. But now we're saying, oh, yes, it passed the blood-brain barrier. Oh, yeah, and it does goes into the heart. And now we're seeing, and first they tried to downplay it, saying, oh, well, if a younger person who's healthy in their 20s gets some form of myocarditis or other inflammation of the heart, that's minor. And yet the actual pathology reports show it's not minor. You could have that the rest of your life. So would you please address what the problems are that we know now that we didn't know at the beginning, that they promised this wouldn't be a problem, that now is a major problem. And so we may be looking at a whole population group around the world who got the various vaccines and who now may be facing some really serious, if not life-threatening conditions. And there is nowhere they can turn to because everyone's been identified from responsibility and medicine has been denying side effects. And so we're not getting an honest equation of how many people are sick and dying, but even the vaccine adverse event reporting system is now up to about 14,000 in the United States. It would have been double that, but they have the numbers 3 weeks ago. But in Europe, it's over 25,000 with over 2.2 million injuries, including half of those over a million serious injuries, some life challenging. So when you're looking at how many people have actually been injured and died, and you look at the real numbers, we're looking at a lot of people who got vaccinated who are now going to be suffering, and yet the government denies it, the medical doctors giving the vaccines, the pharmacists and nurses deny it, but the people who are telling us the problem are some of those whistleblowers inside. Could you address the real impact of this virus vaccine when it goes into your body, and that these conditions could be serious? And how many young people don't realize if you have one of these injuries to your heart, you may not be able to get over that in any short period of time.
Yeah, thank you. And that's a broad topic to cover, and I'm happy to do so. And thanks for covering those early treatment medicines and the data on that, because that's so important. And to your point, you know, remdesivir, a VA study recently showed, look, it actually extends stay. It doesn't cut mortality. It increases morbidity. We know in animal trials, 25% of animals ended up in kidney failure with remdesivir. It's only useful in the first couple of days of viral replication. By the time most patients are in the hospital, they're in the inflammatory stage. They're not even in the viral replication stage. It's the wrong medicine at the wrong time. So thanks for covering that, because it's only beneficial to the back pocket of the pharmaceutical companies and some of the patent interests in the government. It is not a benefit in this disease. The WHO, November 2020, last year said, look, it doesn't work. It didn't extend life. It doesn't improve anything. Stop using it. So a year ago, so you listen to these big mega, you know, YouTube and whatever. Oh, you know, we can only talk about what CDC and WHO says, but you don't hear them saying, oh, by the way, they said a year ago, quit using it. So to your point on that one. Now on to the pathology side and vaccine side. Yes, that stack behind me, those are parts and pieces of people from around the country now. Dr. Schirmacher in Germany did that fantastic 40 autopsy study post-vaccine and showed that 30 to 40% of those deaths in his study, and he got flack for it, but 30 to 40% of those deaths post-vaccine were caused by the vaccine. And so if you look at those studies out of Europe and their VAERS data and our VAERS data, the Eurovigilance data, and you know that combined almost 40,000 people dead, well, we can say with reasonable pathologic confidence based on the studies, and there are not enough of them so far, and I'm getting tissues from post-vaccine injured or deaths around the country now that I've connected to a lot of my colleagues, and we are doing the studies here. They're few and far between, but we'll have enough data to show accurately what's present where. So anyway, if you count those 40,000 deaths, at least 40% of those were indeed the vaccine, even though the naysayers in the media say, oh, those are just antiquated reporting systems. Well, they've been adequate for 30 years as red flag reporting systems. And to your point, those data numbers are underreported and are likely far, far higher than that in terms of adverse events from these shots. And again, these are an experiment that we've never done, and people still want to think, oh, vaccine is all you hear in the news. They every time leave the word investigational off of that. And people think we have an approved one in the U.S. now. We don't. Comirnaty, BioNTech, yes, it's approved, but the only thing still available that got an emergency extension is Pfizer, which is still an experimental emergency authorized shot. And so all of these are still investigational. Anybody that chooses to get a shot, yes, you are in a large clinical trial, the largest we've ever done on humanity. And if you look at those data points of death, of injury, this series of shots has been the most injurious of any drug, any medication, any vaccine, any therapy that we have ever given to humanity in the history of modern medicine. And yet we still allow it to be on the market causing injury. Now, does everybody get injured from it? No. You have to look at numerators and denominators, certainly. But what's the cost benefit risk when otherwise you could have said, hey, look, you're at low risk from this disease. And if you do get sick, guess what? We're going to early treat you with any and all of those things you listed. You will get natural immunity and be immune forever. And you don't have to put yourself at risk for unknown long-term complications from an experimental vaccine. So again, this one size fits all has been illogical. And to your point, yes, a shot goes in the arm, but those spike... The spike proteins do circulate in the body, and the biodistribution studies do show that they accumulate in the liver and strongly in the ovary in certain studies. And we don't know the long-term meaning other than I'm finding some of those proteins in some of these tissues. And once we have enough data points and enough autopsies, we will print our data and show here's the inflammation from the spike protein landing in the heart and or in the immune cells that are landing in the heart, triggering even more and more inflammation. And to your point about the youth, we are seeing more damage in the youth from the shot than we are from the virus. And it's, again, it's kind of apples to oranges, because it's that lack of will to say, okay, somebody's sick, let's early treat them. They'll say, oh, but COVID can cause myocarditis too. Yes, it can. But guess what? If you early treat it and clear that virus quickly, then no, it doesn't. And so that lack of will to treat early is a will to cause damage. It's malfeasance not to treat early. I mean, we have treatments that save lives. We have telehealth services. there are a lot of local doctors that won't do it because they're bought into the AMA or the news media or the common narrative, won't look at that voluminous data that you put forth, that it's incredibly accurate. And this will to say, go home and suffer, is not why I went into medicine. I went into medicine to make a difference, to save a life. And these doctors that are, some of them, bless their hearts, they're stuck in systems. If they speak out or do anything, they'll lose their job. So we've got a systems approach that is literally killing people using drugs that are injurious and avoiding the use of drugs that are life-saving. It's incomprehensible. So going back to the pathology findings, myocarditis in kids, yes, it's markedly increased. And a lot of it silenced. If you look at a study out of the Providence Health System here in the Northwest, they did kind of a quiet lab study on patients admitted to the hospital for other things that had been vaccinated, but they found that the heart injury marker troponin was elevated in 62% increase over baseline of what they would normally see in any given year of myocarditis. So they're like, wait a minute, these patients are being admitted for other things. Let's measure this. And we know they're vaccinated. And so there's this silent epidemic of damage happening and an underreporting. And for example, in the laboratory, somebody gets a shot and they seem fine. They may be achy or whatnot. But if we look at their blood, there's a clotting factor called a D-dimer. And we're starting studies on this and there are other doctors studying it. You don't see these clots on CT scan or radiology procedures because these clots are too small. But in the laboratory, in these post-vaccinated patients, they have this clotting factor drastically elevated, which says to me, in microvessels all around the body, in the brain, in the heart, in the livers, in the kidney, et cetera, these people have clots forming. And what does that do? That chokes off oxygen to your tissue in those areas. That causes a lot of damage. A lot of that can be long-term. And again, I'm not pro-vax, anti-vax, I'm pro-good science. I'm not vaccine hesitant. Yeah, I've had COVID, I'm COVID recovered, I'm immune, I'll never get a vax. But I've had all my childhood ones and lots of military ones, but I'm pro-good science. And when people say, oh gosh, you're vaccine skeptic or hesitant, I drive a car. When a new model comes out, I usually don't buy that first year model. It's not because I'm car hesitant or car skeptic. I'm car thoughtful. So I'm vaccine thoughtful. I'm about the science of what we're doing. Is it good science or is it bad science? In my medical opinion, a lot of it is bad science. And so we need to be intellectually, medically honest and say, where are the large studies? Where is the funding for 10,000 autopsies instead of advertising for a shot for which we don't know long-term outcomes? Where's the real funding from NIH to say we want independent reviews of those injured, not the vaccine companies reviewing their own data, the fox guarding the hen house? We want independent observers. You know, I don't care if it's me or not. I'm doing this at my own dime just because I'm scientifically curious. But there are other universities that could get big grants, and they're saying, oh, there's no such thing as a vaccine injury. There's no such thing as a vaccine death. Hogwash. You talk to anybody you know, and they know somebody that's injured or dead from it. And where's the funding to do these studies? It's really scientifically disturbing to see we're at this point societally to where which we're not even willing to look. And you can't find that for the which you do not look.
Dr. Ryan Cole, we're unfortunately out of time. And in the next couple of months, we'll know even more reality. But you've given us enough to think about, and we really appreciate it. So thank you for being on today.
Thank you so much. It was an honor. I appreciate it.
Dr. Ryan Cole, I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day, everyone, and we're always here, even if it's a holiday, to share important insights and information.